Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy, powered by the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation.
If we had known the 2023 legislative session was going to end up in an Animal House food fight, we'd have invested in popcorn. Stocks. I want to start that over again.
The looks
on your face is like, oh my God, really? All right.
Well, I was doing the John Belushi.
It's a zit, get it? Yeah.
That's right.
Do it. Go for it, Arnold.
If we'd known the 2023 legislative session was going to end up in an Animal House food fight, we'd have invested in popcorn stocks. The governor bullying the Senate by vetoing 20 bills, the Senate president suggesting the governor needs to sober up, the House Speaker doing an about-face on vouchers siding with the schoolyard bully, the Senate president calling the Speaker's ideas asinine. Woohoo! Less than a month to go, or maybe this is just the beginning. The legislature's principal job is to pass a budget. Will the hard feelings get smoothed over in time to avoid a special session or two? We invited House Democratic Floor Leader Andy Fugate to be our special guest this week. He's someone who doesn't just have a front row seat. He's actually on the legislative stage, dodging flying cups and plates as the Republican supermajority goes to war. Andy, and I wish people could see this, over your shoulder is Kingston the Tyrant dressed appropriately.
King George III, yep.
Yeah. And Arnold, to your lead-in, following in that same thing, you know, unfortunately, the governor and leadership expect all of us to stand around and say, thank you, sir, may I have another?
Yep.
Sorry, I shouldn't have done that while you were drinking coffee.
We're just going to keep up the Animal House analogies here.
It just went down the wrong button. You know, I guess Animal House is a classic. I feel like I'm so old when I use these Animal House references, but you know,
they're timeless.
It's still relevant today, right?
Wait until we start talking about double secret blind probation.
So are you the Kevin Bacon in this study? They're saying all is well. All is well.
Oh, I would hope you'd be Otter instead or something. You know.
Exactly.
I'm a fan of Otter, that's for sure. But we might end this by, you know, singing the battle hymn of the Republican, you know, kind of marching out. And
oh, I know how we're going to end this now. Okay, yes, I know the music. I know it's got to be public. Okay.
I can't do John Belushi's speech justice, but it sure is running in my head right now. And that's the history, unfortunately, that our superintendent of schools believes in his head.
Yeah, isn't that something? Holy shnikes.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, and remember, John Belushi became a U.S. senator.
That's right.
Oh my gosh, we're all living in an alternate reality.
I've always compared this alternate reality to Idiocracy, but you know, there might be something to your theme.
Holy
theory.
So what the hell's going on?
Well, I just kind of wonder, like, who's D-Day in all this, right? Because, you know, D-Day goes on to be like the heavy cop in all the future like TV serials and stuff. So I was like, who is D-Day? we gotta really like be careful with whose side we're putting on who, right? So anyways, yeah.
So it's just gonna get plunked with a golf ball.
Yeah.
I imagine 90% of this will wind up on the cutting room floor, right?
Oh, no. We go for authenticity, yeah.
No.
Which is fine.
Yeah, and it's too good, too. So,
you know, and I think, Andy, have talked a little bit about this, that, you know, the old line used to be that Democrats fall in love and Republicans fall in line, and these are not my father's Republicans who are operating at 23rd and Lincoln these days. My goodness, they're trying to steal Will Rogers' line about Democrats.
I'm just nodding my head in agreement.
Okay. Well, I killed the conversation with that one, I guess. But so what? Give us an overview here. What do you think's going on here, and how do you think this is going to play out?
Well, we can start with a governor whose leadership style is to be charitably characterized inept, incompetent, and childish. It is very clear that he was CEO of his own personal business, and the leadership skills, such as they are, that he acquired, very clearly don't translate to governing a state. You know, the ideas of using the bully pulpit to get the public on board, or building consensus with the people that you work with, that frankly control the power of the purse. You take a look at the list of folks that the governor has offended along the course of his, you know, 5 years, whether it's veterans or native peoples in the state of Oklahoma, and, you know, creating the worst state in the nation in which to be a woman. The list is just enormous, because we put into office a person who has no idea how to govern, who didn't even pay attention to government enough to even, you know, cast a vote as an adult until he decided to run himself. And then you compound that with what appear to be large egos and ambitions at play from others. And that's a toxic soup that has been created. Now, I'm going to give you the spoiler right here for all of those who are listening and who might not want to listen to the end of this show. It's all performative. The stuff you are seeing today, where, you know, the House is sticking it to the Senate, and the Senate is sticking it to the governor, and the governor's, you know, making his own pronouncements, and people calling each other asinine and all of that, it's all performative. The intent is to put on a show for the people. And then when they come down from the mountaintop with their, and I'm using air quotes here, negotiated agreement, it will be passed by fiat, by folks who are just lined up, ready to go.
So, I mean, this really started, though, when McCall kind of, you know, threw his first volley over, you know, saying if his House bill with his voucher scheme, because we're not going to call it anything else. It's a voucher scheme, right? A gambit, a fraud, a whatever, a bamboozle, whatever you want to call it. But when he threatened the Senate, saying, if you send this back to me with any amendments, I'm not going to, you know, it's not going to pass. And so, I mean, they have been at each other's throats performatively, to your point. This entire session over this one issue, and it's, you know, hamstringing the entire session.
Agreed.
All over this that will throttle our rural school districts.
Well,
yes. I mean, does that sound accurate?
Yes. They, you know, part of this is they had to find a mechanism to get rural legislators to support something that's very clearly going to hurt their schools. And the way they did that was by crafting a package, and mind you, it's a one-year package for rural schools that bypasses the state funding formula to provide additional dollars to rural schools so they can all feel good about the fact that they're going to get all this extra money that the big schools aren't getting. And then next year, not realizing it, the rug will be yanked out from underneath them. But guess what stays in the package? Taxpayer subsidized private schooling for kids who already attend private schools. There are nearly 40,000 of them in the state of Oklahoma who will get, at a minimum, based off of all the plans that are on the table. And these are things that all and I won't say all of a majority of a supermajority of Republicans have voted for. The plans begin at $5,000. They provide no oversight for the taxpayer, other than through the use of an audit from the tax commission, which has a perverse reverse incentive to discourage low-income families from taking advantage of any kind of taxpayer subsidies. I mean, who wants to risk having a tax audit when you're trying to figure out how to use TurboTax to file your taxes, right? So it was very clearly intended to find a package for rural legislators that they could get on board with, sweetening the pot, you know, in rural Oklahoma, they're going to get roughly $1,000 more per kid. Remember, for 1 year, and then it goes back at the expense of larger school districts like Middell Public Schools, where, you know, I represent, which will get about $100 per kid.
So I'm just, okay, I'm pulling this way out of the wormhole of the first year of the Sid administration, right? But wasn't this the governor that strenuously objected to one-time funding for anything?
Yes.
And then now that's his, this is his dream plan, right? Like,
well, so the funding will remain, although the latest plans don't have the poison pill provision on the tax credits. That's, so the original proposal had a tax credit that was put on hold temporarily anytime funding for schools dropped. And I'm not saying next year that funding for public schools will drop, but what will happen is that money will go back into the state's equalization formula. Mm-hmm. And it's the formula that has been bypassed in the House plan to get rural legislators on board. That's the one that sends all the money to, doesn't matter where your kids go to school, they're all going to get, you know, equal treatment, which is just nonsense. What it does is it penalizes poor schools by giving money to wealthy school districts. So Freedom Oklahoma spends, believe it or not, $36,000 per kid in the classroom. They've been off the funding formula for so long, it's ridiculous, because they have a lot of local contribution, local money that far exceeds any dollars they would get from the state of Oklahoma. So they don't get any money from the state. But in the plan that's proposed this year by the House, they'll get about $1,000 more per student at the expense of most of the rest of the school districts in the state of Oklahoma. But that's 1 year, and then it reverts to, unless they decide to do something again next year, I suspect most members won't be paying attention, and they'll just put the money back into the state funding formula. So this is okay.
First of all, I just clarify it. Freedom Oklahoma, Freedom, the school district in the town of Freedom Oklahoma, not the organization Freedom Oklahoma.
Yeah. Freedom Oklahoma.
Yeah, yes. I was like, wait, what? Huh? And so sorry.
I should have used Pryor Oklahoma. So Pryor Oklahoma spends $15,470 per kid in the classroom. It's the reason why Panasonic wasn't telling us you need to invest more in education, because they're doing fine there.
That's what really, okay, yeah, and this is the thing, right? Like, I just realized this, the dots connected right there for me. This is why all these deals are going to Freedom, or going to Pryor, Oklahoma, right? Like, this is why we see the Mid-America, blah, blah, whatever it's called, where they're supposed to land, like, all these big factories and stuff. Okay, that makes sense.
Well, anyways, there is more to that story. I mean, they do have low-cost electricity there from the GRDA. They do have a shovel-ready, quasi-shovel-ready industrial park there, large-scale industrial park that has access to transportation, a number of things that make it more suitable than other parts of the state. And the reason Google went there is because of low cost of electricity. The Google data center's there. And that's part one of the primary reasons why the local tax contribution is so large in Pryor, Oklahoma. You know, the governor made a stink a couple of years back about trying to change the law in the state of Oklahoma, change the constitution, actually, to allow property taxes to be used to fund classrooms. Well, 35 mills of it already does. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, normally is not a major contributor to the classroom, because in most places in Oklahoma, the property tax values are not that large. But in selected places like Pryor, Oklahoma, they're enormous. So much so that they outweigh any dollars that would be received from the state.
this is a little off the topic. I just want to veer over here for a second on the Mid-America Industrial Park and Pryor and all that and why it's looking. One of the major problems, though, with that over there is you really don't have the employment base necessary, and you don't have the housing stock available if you're going to bring in one of these big companies, right? I mean, I don't want to go off into that direction very far, but I want people to think about that. It's kind of an odd thing. We keep rolling these things out there, but there are so many reasons why this doesn't work and why it ends up being used by companies to get a better deal elsewhere.
Well, yeah. And in this case, we have the governor now pitching again. You got to think about how lousy a negotiator that the governor is, where we have this $750 million incentive sitting on the table. And that's just the state's portion. That's not all the local contributions through TIFs or whatever else they might put in place. He can't get the deal done. So what he does is he goes in and throws another $250 million on the table. He's desperate to find something to hang his hat on because he's been an abject failure when it comes to negotiating on behalf of the people of Oklahoma.
So let's think about his strategy here in all this for a minute, and vetoing all these Senate bills to show who's in charge.
Before we do that, can I throw one other thing in?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
In terms of Mid-America, it's noteworthy what Panasonic asked for when they, on that $250 million, it was infrastructure. So they wanted better roads. They wanted more fire stations. And this is the governor saying this. We've not actually seen what he negotiated. They wanted more daycares and they wanted more community investment. Well, guess what that is? That's $250 million in quality of life. And why do the people in Pryor, Oklahoma, and why does Panasonic deserve that and the rest of Oklahoma doesn't?
Correct.
We got $6.2 billion from the governor's own mouth. Why aren't we spending that on quality of life improvements for the entire state so we don't have to pay off businesses to the tune of $1 billion to get them to even consider coming here?
Or how about we create, sorry, I know you want to go a different direction. How about we create business parks throughout Oklahoma to, stimulate the economy in other areas of the state and not just Pryor, Oklahoma, right?
We are doing some of that. Remember, all those ARPA dollars, we've got nearly $2 billion of Biden bucks that we will be spending. It's the first major infrastructure investment we've had in nearly 50 years in rural Oklahoma. And we're not paying for it ourselves. We're indirectly, because some of those are Oklahoma taxpayer dollars, but it's all Biden bucks. Mm-hmm. We could be taking some of that $6.2 billion and doing a dollar for dollar match. Mm-hmm. What if we spent $4 billion in this state rebuilding Oklahoma?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and we already know, because of what Oklahoma City and Tulsa have done, that all this, again, performance politics, the Senate President's Committee, that's going to look at why we're losing out on all these. How in the world can this possibly happen to Oklahoma? Well, we know why, and we know what works. And in Oklahoma City and Tulsa, taxpayers have invested in themselves and created a better quality of life. And they poured a bunch of money into public schools in Oklahoma City. They still have a long way to go, obviously, but still, those are the kinds of things that people are looking for. And companies like Panasonic are going to have a hard time getting folks, if they're going to have to attract people to come in and help. Northeastern Oklahoma is wonderful. There are lots of great things about it, but there are a lot of reasons not to want to go there.
It's a big, big state too. And there's other areas of the state that one could be connected, regionally a lot better, but also need the economic development. And it's, you would think there would be that moment, maybe like at 2 a.m. for Governor Sitt. And he's like, aha, maybe what Panasonic was telling me was something we just need to do in general. They keep saying no to me. I can't figure out why.
The OCPA is whispering in his ear.
Yeah. So he's a little and devil.
That's all he's hearing. He's not actually going in and studying these issues himself.
Or just the self-reflection of, gosh, I can't quite figure out why we can't get to yes. We can only get to no. Anyways, you know, Arnold, back to your.
Although I was going to say we need a psychiatrist and or a psychologist on to sort of break down this personality type that, you know, you're dealing with here with him. And maybe that's an episode somewhere down the line that we do. But, yeah, you know, I was just thinking, though, about him vetoing these Senate bills to sort of show who's boss or to show his power. I, you know, whatever it is he's trying to do. But I find it really interesting. The guy clearly doesn't understand what really makes Oklahoma tick. This is a guy who vetoes the name, image, likeness legislation that all the football fans in Oklahoma are just erupting and saying this is going to destroy any chance that OU and OSU have to compete against Texas and others. Oh, my God. And then... Now I can sort of understand OETA from the standpoint that there's part of his cabal, and this is where the OCPA is whispering in his ears that says that's liberal public it's not free market but boy, there are an awful lot of people around this state who rely on OETA and
it was 10 years ago this year that the House lined up against Newberry, the guy that he was like that guy who was trying to do something similar to this and sunset the funding for OETA. In the House, almost half of the House lined up to debate against it because they're like, this is what my neighborhood watches. This is what my grandma watches. This is all the TV that some of my people in my district have. So anyways.
They don't watch that anymore. All those people are watching Fox News now.
If they can get cable where they're at.
Or afford it in a lot of cases. Right. So, yeah, one would think he might have been a little smarter about what hornet's nests he poked. Or no.
He's been tilting at that windmill with OETA for a couple of years now. You know, he vetoed the antenna replacements that next generation 911 was going to also be utilizing. Mm-hmm. And he got away with that without too much outrage and outcry. So I think he feels like he's got a safe bet.
All right. NIL though is a totally different.
Yeah. Name, image, and likeness is an interesting one. I don't know that it is as, leaves us in such an uncompetitive state because we're not eliminating NIL. All we're doing is delaying some of the tweaks, and the chief tweaks among them are changes to the agency process, who can represent somebody, and the ability for a booster club to pay for name, image, and likeness. And that one's a significant one. You know, if a rich donor in a quarterback club wants to, you know, pay some kid to come play football, that still technically is illegal, but they can certainly, under this new law, when it does come into effect, and it will, they're just waiting for the right time. And so they're probably still telling these kids, don't worry about it. We got you covered. But the boosters will then be able to purchase, air quotes, the name, image, and likeness of a kid they want to have come play for OU or, yeah, some degrees OSU.
That's a whole other episode, I guess.
It is.
Yeah, we should have a conversation about it all being above board and.
Yeah,
the university should be paying these guys. That's my view.
Well,
it has been for a long
boosters
time.
Boosters making college football players their puppets because they control their name, image, and likeness is so problematic as well. But that's a dissertation right there. But
but boy, that's, you know, that's the kind of thing though that people, you know, I've been astonished at, you know, this is the thing that's gotten people's panties in a wad, you know, on social media is this whole notion that suddenly the governor has put us behind the eight ball when it comes to recruiting, not the other stuff. That's really the important stuff. I mean, you know, once again, it's football.
Right.
So I don't know. It just, it just does. That makes no sense to me on this whole thing either.
Okay, so procedurally, how does this impact the legislature? What does it mean, like, in practical terms for the day-to-day operations of the legislature?
Well, I think for the next week or so, we'll go around with our arms crossed and everybody having scowling, angry faces, pointing fingers and shouting at each other until they come down from the mountaintop with their negotiated agreement and have everybody bless it and go on. In terms of the practical applications, I don't know whether the legislature will come back and override some of these vetoes or whether they will just use other legal processes, legislative processes to put that language into other places where it'll still go into effect for those things that they really want to support. There are at least three ways they could continue to do that. So the first of which is they can get a supermajority in both chambers to approve new deadlines. So, and that would allow them to continue to work on whatever bills they want to work on. And they can have the speaker or the pro tem introduce new legislation because they can do that at any time. Or they could, on an individual bill by bill basis, via supermajority in both chambers, remove the deadlines on those bills. And so, you know, they could leave those vetoes hanging out there. That's fine. Write a new bill, does exactly the same thing, or take an existing bill, shuck the language, which means to scrape it all out and turn it into an empty shell, like you would an oyster, and insert. And we did some of that shucking this week because we were crossing our arms and, you know, sticking it to the Senate. Sadly, we shucked some really good language, helping families, for instance, receiving TANF, that's the temporary assistance for needy families. Today, they have to sell off their vehicles. And, you know, the maximum dollar value of the vehicle they're allowed to maintain is under $5,000. And you think about what $5,000 today buys in a vehicle.
So it's a real jalopy.
And so you're telling these people who are right now, you know, the idea behind TANF is it's temporary, right? So you're putting a family whose situation is temporarily in jeopardy and saying them to them, the only way you're going to be able to feed your kids or pay, you know, some of your bills is to sell off all your assets until you're down to a car that's worth less than $5,000, a single vehicle. And you have to figure out how to get you and your spouse from point A to point B. And oh, by the way, you know,
you're supposed to work. You're supposed to go to work somehow. So,
and you got to take your kids to that $18,000 a year private school they attend.
They don't bus you there.
Yeah. So,
okay. So here's my question about this though. So, it's not just the governor vetoing stuff. There's an impasse between the House and the Senate right now, right? Yes. Like, I mean, as Forrest Bennett illustrated, you know, on social media, he's like, he tried to go over to the Senate and talk to the author of his bill on the Senate side, and he was blocked from going into the Senate. And so there's this impasse, literally like impasse between both chambers. So even if they could introduce new bills, you know, if the speaker and the Senate pro tem could introduce new bills, are they going to get to the other chamber? Because they have to pass both chambers.
Oh yeah, they will. Because I mean, the reality is, and both of you are seasoned and savvy enough to know this, and probably lots of your listeners as well, the real action doesn't happen on the floor.
Conference committee,
either conference committee or behind closed doors, you know, and for those who are listening, conference committee isn't what you think it is. There's not like this big committee process where they have open hearings and discussion of ideas and everything else. It's a whole lot of closed doors and, you know, cigar filled smoke rooms.
Yeah, so basically it's when there's a piece of legislation that goes back to its house of origin and it has been amended in the other chamber. The chamber in the house of origin doesn't agree to those amendments. And if they can't come up with a solution, so it goes back and forth until all the authors, you know, accept the amendments, right? And so
house of enough.
enough. And then it goes back. If it doesn't do that, it goes to conference committee. And that is literally not, like you said, where somewhere people come into a room together. There is a quorum. People discuss, they vote, and the public knows about it. It literally happens behind closed doors. And that's where you can see all sorts of new language amendments, kind of crazy stuff get inserted into to legislation that was before may have been kind of sane. I mean, crazy stuff can happen in conference committee.
Yep. The rules specifically permit that. A bill that goes into conference can be turned into literally anything else.
So this is where we could really see a lot of the pernicious, shall I say, shit come out from conference committee. And maybe this was the end game.
Well, it won't be shit. It'll be stit, but it's close.
Okay, so to my point, like, this is where we might see this legislation come out. And when we see it back in the daylight,
agreed.
I mean, this is the scary part.
Well, and like the budget itself, which is, you know, almost like picking a new pope, you know, you're waiting to see whether the black smoke or the white smoke comes up through the, you know.
And if the entire legislature has, what, even 3 days to look at the
exactly
budget.
So all this stuff is crammed into the last, basically, the meat and potatoes of this whole thing unfolds in the last few days, and you guys having no time to review or scant time to review these sorts of things.
Because I mean, let's just, you know, kind of recap what happens here. We're in the last month of session, and these fools like to get out early. They don't like to run the clock out and just take their time and get stuff done, right? So they don't want to spend, you know, up until 5 p.m. on the Friday before Memorial Day working. They don't.
That's part of the performance, because
they don't want to work on Friday.
That way they can claim, see how well we run this thing? We never have, you know, we get out
early. They don't want to come into session on a Friday because they want to be back home in their districts or whatever. And so, you know, they will not spend time discussing the budget. You guys will get it. And by you guys, I mean the Democrats and some of the lower, you know, the backbench Republicans, who won't see a thing about this budget until it's on the floor. Meanwhile, so it just makes me wonder how much.
It puts us on par with the governor, though.
Yeah, I mean, but you have to realize, like, maybe there's all this fracas between Governor, House, and Senate. Maybe it's to redirect attention away from what's going to come out as a budget. But there's also the possibility that they haven't talked about it at all yet, because
I do have a very healthy respect for Roger Thompson.
Yeah.
In the Senate, and I, you know, it wouldn't surprise me to see a budget that really didn't implement nearly as much as the governor is asking for. Roger is a big believer in public education. I think he's willing to go along if the members want to do it, to find some way to provide taxpayer subsidized private schooling. I don't think he believes that's the way to fix education, air quote fix, but I think he might go along with that. But the governor's tax cuts, we just got one last year. The people of Oklahoma and corporations in Oklahoma just got a tax cut last year. And I keep asking constituents, do you notice you got a tax cut last year?
And we still had to pay taxes this year.
Yeah. So the only people who realized they got a tax cut last year were people who had the means to do a maximum contribution to the governor's campaign. In the state of Oklahoma, the median income is $56,865. That's a family of four, right? And half of those families in Oklahoma make that or less. That's what median means. It's not an average. It means half of Oklahoma makes less than that. Do you know what that family got for a tax cut last year? $34. It amounts to 9.3 cents per day. I mean, if nothing else, give them a grocery tax cut. For those low-income families, you're talking about a $200 per year tax cut. That's helpful. I don't know whether or not that might actually pass. But, you know, I saw the governor's spokesperson. I was going to use a more pejorative term, but I won't. clamoring, saying, you know, if not this year, then when? And I think the governor may have said that too. Well, when was last year? That's when.
Right. When was 2013? I mean, my God, like.
Yeah. You know, this whole tax voucher thing that the governor's trying to do and the House is trying to do. You know, I've been doing a little thinking just kind of about that in general. And that $7,500 under the governor's plan covers just over two max contributions to them. Mm. Or somebody who contributed in the primary and a runoff. And, you know, this is nothing more than putting money back in their pockets so they can continue to contribute, because those people are already paying for their kids to go to those schools. Mm-hmm. It's worth noting for everybody who's listening that all of the cost estimates you see don't include a penny, not a penny, for any new kid to attend one of those schools. They are all predicated on the existing kids who will their families will make out like bandits because they've already figured out how to pay for this stuff.
Well, this is all about getting the nose further under the tent, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, because there's nothing to prevent private schools in Oklahoma from simply raising tuition more.
Right? I asked that question on the floor. Is there anything in this language that would prohibit a private school from raising their tuition? At that time, it was the $5,000 plan by $5,000. And I was told no. If they wanted to do that, why should we tell them they couldn't? There is not one of these premier private schools who's looking at this as an opportunity to say, you know what? We need to build a new wing for low-income kids to come out here to Heritage Hall or to Bishop McGinnis or to Mount St. Mary's. They're not doing that. They're looking at that saying, hey, you know, we're going to raise our tuition by another $3,000. We'll let people keep $2,000 so they'll feel good, and we'll have better teachers, better facilities for our kids, and the wall stays up.
So what's the solution here politically? What can be done, if anything? Just hope that the thing implodes?
Well,
before we get there, there's something I wanted to bring up though, and oh my gosh, now it just went outside my head. Okay. Can we talk about the graphic behind you? Sorry, my eyes are itching really bad right now. To the graphic behind you, what has really peeved me about this is it's not just the legislation that has gotten vetoed, because there were great bills in there that are meaningful bills that really would make a difference besides name, image and likeness stuff. But it's the fact that STIT refuses to go out and be a statesman about this and talk to the legislature and win them over, right? He refuses to have a conversation with the legislature himself, the legislature himself, and be a statesman about this and come to consensus and find something. Instead, he just issues mandates and edicts, right? Saying this. I mean, he issued a compromise.
He adopted the House plan, tweaked it to make it the House light plan, and then claimed it as his own. And it's no wonder the House lined up right behind it. It was basically what we had proposed.
Yeah. And McCall, you know, proposed, right? And so,
yeah, correction.
Why can't this man go? And this is what we saw last year. This is just how he works. And I think this is something that we have to point out, is that it's his way or the highway. He does not want to, you know, he doesn't want to govern, right? He does not want to lead. He doesn't want to build relationships. He doesn't want to bring people together to find a solution. He just wants what he wants, and that's it. And this is how we found ourselves. But even if it is just performative, it's so problematic because of all the people that are left behind and all the voices that aren't at the table as a result.
Yes, I would just point out that's nearly always the case at the Capitol. Those people don't have voices. So, you know, this issue isn't necessarily vastly different than most other issues where the people of Oklahoma are being left out. And it's been that way for, you know, at least two decades. I do want to kind of, you know, share with you as a freshman, when the governor was elected same year I was, and he was doing his due diligence at that time, trying to build some relationships at the outset, because that's what he was advised he should do, before he had folks who were yammering his ear from the OCPA, et cetera, and CPAC, et cetera. And so he invited us to breakfasts. And I had one opportunity to have breakfast at the governor's mansion under this governor. And there were six, seven of us who were there, who were members, both parties. And the governor was going around asking us, you know, about various things. And I gave him advice at that point and said, you know, if you're going to run this government like a business, don't think of it like a personal private business. Think of it like a multinational conglomerate where you have a board of directors that you have to report to. You have separate lines of business where customers don't cross. Think of it in that way. And those kinds of leaders don't spend their time going around telling people how to think. They spend their time finding the most effective people, the most experienced, the most informed. And they put them in positions where they can do good things. And then their job as CEO is to clear the decks. It's to help cast a common vision and then to communicate that vision out to the customer base. Or in the case of the governor, use the bully pulpit and go to the people of Oklahoma. That's what leadership is about. And that's, to me, what a governor ought to be doing. And this governor, his immature leadership gets in the way every single day.
But that also takes effort, Andy.
It's what you sign up for.
Well, unless you don't know what you truly signed up for, except the title.
Fair point.
You know,
he can't have people that dissent with him around him. He can't. He doesn't do it. And we've seen that in the way he's cleared agencies. You know, he can't have people giving him honest opinions that disagree.
I agree 100%, but yeah, I will share my pitch one more time. When you're in that situation, you are stuck with a vision from somebody who's generally speaking going to be lightly informed at best about most of the things that need to happen for the people of Oklahoma. And so we are hamstrung, severely hamstrung when that happens. You know, if, and I'm not saying this of the governor, but say the governor were, you know, well, I won't even go to that. Forget I even said that. Just know that we are then bound by one person instead of being empowered by people who really are informed about these issues, who are put in positions where they can make things happen.
So what are we looking at the next month in the legislature? What do you predict?
The circle behind my head is not a crystal ball. I may be the least politically savvy member of the legislature, and that includes all of the freshmen. So my opinions are so lightly informed. You know, my friend Eugene Ursum likes to use the quote from Marcus Aurelius, the opinions of 10,000 men are worthless if they are not informed. So I'm just laying the playing field out there, or you know what I mean? Whatever cliche is appropriate there, just insert that disclaimer. But I think we will probably go for another week where we will reject amendments on both sides. We probably won't have and force things to go to conference. even for things where we like what the Senate has done and vice versa, as part of the performative politics of this. I mean, it's easy to send something to conference and then turn right around and have the committee, air quotes, approve whatever was sent to conference. So that'll be part of the performance that goes on. They will continue to bash each other publicly while they are behind the scenes waiting for the right time to come out and announce their agreement. And they will continue to try to stoke the flames within the two chambers, getting each other to hate on them so that they can, they're building buy-in into leadership to getting all of the members lined up for whatever it is they announce. And then after about a week, they'll announce that. And then, bam, things will be happening. They'll have bills that will be brought to light with barely a moment's notice. You know, you don't even have to, with a supermajority, you don't have to give 24 hours notice on a bill. You can put it on the floor sight unseen. That happens with a budget. You know, I asked a couple of years ago, one of the members carrying a piece of the budget on the floor about a provision of it. And he just kind of shrugged sheepishly and said, I literally got this 5 minutes before we got on the floor. He's a person carrying the bill, had no idea what his bill does, how the money was going to be spent. So the rules in the hands of a supermajority allow that to happen. So you'll see that happening. You know, they'll call back the two governor's appointees that they rejected on the Senate side, and they will approve them, and all will be well. I don't think, I mean, if there's one piece in all this stuff that's being fought over, I don't think tax reductions will happen this year. I do think, and there's a piece we haven't talked about, the governor has something called the Legacy Fund. He has this, air quotes, brilliant idea to sock away enough taxpayer dollars that we can fund future tax cuts off of the interest earnings from the amount of that corpus, the total amount of money we socked away. And that's something that I fully expect to see happen, even though it was killed by deadlines this past week. The governor's workforce task force. I will give you a data point on that. I asked the question. So the governor wants to put $1.1 billion into his legacy fund. And I asked, at a 5% annual rate of return on that, how much will that raise for the people of Oklahoma? The answer to that is about $55 million. I mean, you just do the back of the math napkin. And a 5% annual rate of return on a investment, a safe investment, is a really good return. So how much would we have invested to pay for the tax cut we got last year for the people of Oklahoma? You'd have to put all that $6 billion into this account and then some.
For 9 cents a day.
For 9.3 cents a day. There are two constitutionally protected funds that exist. The rainy day fund and the TSET fund. There's actually a third in the CLO fund, but that's kind of outside the purview of this. But two that have been created by the people of Oklahoma. And the legislature can't touch those dollars. But by golly, all these other funds, the Reserve Stabilization Fund that we put together and the FMAP fund and all these other things where we're socking away money, those are slush funds that the legislature at any time can tap. And the perfect example of this is the roads fund that, you know, we've been investing in since 2003 to fix roads and bridges on our highways here in the state of Oklahoma. When we wound up in trouble monetarily, we took $200 million out of that fund, and we told the Department of Transportation to replace that with bonded money. So we went out on the market and borrowed money, which the Constitution says we're not supposed to be able to do. But we got around that by saying it was for infrastructure purposes. So my point in all of that is this legacy fund is a giant slush fund that the legislature could tap at a moment's notice without any any input from the people of Oklahoma, and with, frankly, without any transparency.
And those sorts of tools are the reason that, I guess, leadership can say with a straight face that they can keep public school funding at a level or get it to a higher level and it won't be impacted by vouchers.
Yes.
So what do, our listeners do? Say, thank you, sir. May I have another? Or is there something? I mean, it's back to Animal House again.
I like it. We're coming full circle. Yeah.
Stop electing John Belushi.
Wait, whose house are we? Like,
I mean, I wish I could, you know, I, for all those people who think, by golly, we're just going to vote the bums out, I have bad news for you. There were 125 open legislative seats in last November. Do you know how many of them appeared on the November ballot? Well, 87 of us weren't there. You can do the math, whatever that is. 48, I guess, were, or 38. 38 actually appeared on the ballot. And the rest of us, the decision was either made by us individually. I had no opponent, so I'm the only guy who got to decide for my district. And, or it was decided in a primary. And because Oklahoma has closed primaries, half the people in that district never had an opportunity to decide whether or not that person is going to represent them. So when you hear people, and when I hear people say, well, I'm just going to vote you out. Yeah, I had a bill that would let you do that, but the law right now doesn't let you do that. Sorry.
Well, and also some of these races that did happen, you know, three digits turned out in some of these races. And the more local you get, the lower the turnout. Like less than 1,000 people.
You know, I'm, you know, my colleagues keep trying to coalesce elections so that they can have higher turnouts. And I'm a bit of a contrarian there. If you're going to show up for an election, I want you to have done your homework. And, you know, say I put school board members on a November ballot. What I'm going to wind up with is people, one, having ballot fatigue because they're looking now at four pages or five pages of ballots, and they're just going to start checking, you know. And two, you wind up with people who really have not been paying attention, invested in that particular race, who are going to be making lightly informed decisions. And I think that's a lousy way to have democracy. I'm
going to tell you, as long as people are having to work 2-3 jobs just to keep the lights on, that's not going to get better if you have 5 ballots over the course of the year to vote for things, right? So, you know, there's a lot of things that need to be solved before I think we can truly have an involved electorate in the state, poverty being one of them.
Agreed. I'm trying to do my own small part by visiting with folks as best I can to help them understand the process. I'll pitch my Sunday night live stream at 8 p.m. You can go out to Facebook. And I will, yes, provide an advocate's view of what happened the prior week. So be forewarned. But I do also spend a lot of time trying to help people just understand what's happening out there. I spent 30 plus years helping high school kids, working as a volunteer to understand how the process works at the Capitol. And I love doing that, very passionate about it. It's where I was first involved with the Oklahoma Observer, through Frosty Troy. And so if you want to know more about how things work at the Capitol and what's going on, tune in on Sunday evenings. And of course, subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, because you get a very nuanced and informed perspective on what's happening out at the Capitol and what's going on in the state and nation as well through the Observer.
Hey, there's our clip for our commercials. Thanks, Andy.
Oh, you're welcome.
you segued right to what we needed.
Representative Andy Fugate, we really appreciate your time today. After a busy, hectic week with a few more busy, hectic weeks to go before the legislature decides that they don't need to work anymore. So, theoretically speaking, thank you for your insight into this issue. We really appreciate it. And of course, we'd love to have you back again. So, I hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just the resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.